Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a fascinating journey, maybe 1,000 years back.
That's right. Back to the imperial court of Heian, Japan. It's a world that's incredibly refined, complex, maybe even a bit catty sometimes.
And we're diving into a really unique piece of literature. It's not quite a novel, not really an essay.
You could almost call it one of history's earliest and maybe most successful personal blogs. We're talking about The Pillow Book or Makura no Sushi by Sei Shondagon.
Yeah, it's definitely not a conventional history book. And it's not exactly a memoir either, is it?
No, not in our modern sense. It's this amazing, glittering collection of short observations, lists, very opinionated lists, mind you, and sharp little anecdotes, all written around the year 1000 CE.
So imagine sitting right in the heart of this incredibly sophisticated culture. They were obsessed with aesthetics, poetry, social nuance.
Right, and you have this guide, Sei Shondagon, who's just writing down every thought, every judgment, every beautiful moment, every little thing that annoys her.
It's incredibly immediate.
It really is.
So our mission for you, the learner, today, is to give you a kind of shortcut into understanding this amazing work.
Because this deep dive, it really shows how sharp observation and just, you know, paying close attention to the details of daily life can be a profound kind of wisdom.
And it feels completely timeless, doesn't it? It's almost like a manual for living with more awareness.
Absolutely. So let's unpack who this brilliant observer actually was.
Okay. Sei Shondagon. She was a court lady, a poet, a writer, living roughly from 966 to, what, 1025 CE?
Around then, yes. Mm-hmm. And she held a really prestigious position serving Empress Teishi, who was also known as Sadako. This was during the peak of the Heian period.
And her background is important here, right? She wasn't just anyone at court.
Definitely not. She came from the Kiyohara clan, which was known specifically for its scholars and poets. This gave her a fantastic education, especially in Chinese classics and poetry.
Which was pretty unusual for a woman in that era, even a noble woman.
Very unusual. And you can feel that education, that intellectual confidence just radiating from the book. It was like her superpower.
Okay, so that's what makes her perspective so distinct. She's got this incredible dual role.
Exactly. She's a total insider, deeply embedded in all the court's complexity, the social hierarchies, the politics.
But there was also the observer. Mm-hmm. She has the literary skill and maybe the nerve to step back and capture it all.
Mm-hmm. Capture it, celebrate it, but also critique it. She wasn't afraid to judge.
She had a reputation for being pretty confident, didn't she? Mm. Outspoken, maybe even a little arrogant.
Yeah, she's often contrasted with her contemporary Murasaki Shikibu, you know, the author of The Tale of Genji.
Right, Murasaki was seen as more reserved, maybe more melancholic.
Exactly. Shondagon was the sharp, witty, maybe more extroverted one. She wasn't just watching the courtly game. She was playing it and commenting on it the whole time.
I love that. Yeah. Okay, so let's turn to the book itself, The Pillow Book. You said it defies genre.
It really does. It's a prime example, maybe the pioneering example, of a Japanese genre called zuhitsu.
Zuhitsu, what does that mean?
It translates literally as following the brush. Think of it like stream of consciousness writing. There's no rigid structure, no single argument.
Just ideas flowing onto the page. Capturing the moment.
Precisely. The book has around 300 entries, lists, anecdotes, observations, all mixed together. It's like a literary collage.
And the title, The Pillow Book. It sounds so intimate.
Well, the idea, or the custom at the time, was to keep paper and writing things near your pillow, maybe in a little box.
Ah, so you could jot down thoughts or inspirations right away.
Mm-hmm.
Before they vanish.
Exactly. Maybe a funny story you heard, a line of poetry that came to you, or something that just really irritated you.
So that kind of defines the purpose of the writing then. It's not about building some grand narrative.
No, it's about preserving the ephemeral. She's tackling that age-old problem of transience, of things passing away. She arrests these moments, beauty, humor, annoyance in her prose before they just disappear from memory.
She's basically giving us a masterclass in heightened awareness.
That's a great way to put it. She teaches you, the reader, to notice the significance in seemingly tiny things.
It's not about big historical events. It's about the way light filters through blinds, or the specific rules of court etiquette, or just how funny human vanity can be.
Right. The overarching theme is really the art of living with this refined sensibility, paying attention.
Okay, so to really get a handle on how she does this, you mentioned organizing her writing into three main types.
Yeah, broadly speaking, you can see three kinds of entries: lists, anecdotes, and diary entries. Let's start with maybe her most famous style, the lists.
Ah, yes, the things the lists, hateful things, elegant things.
Exactly. These lists are fascinating because they show her trying to categorize experience. It's like she's creating her own personal taxonomy of the world.
Splendid things, things that lose by being painted, things that gain by being painted.
And some are purely aesthetic or analytical, like things that cannot be compared. She lists things like summer and winter, night and day, love and hate.
She's not saying one is better, just that they are fundamentally distinct experiences.
Right. It shows this real drive for clarity, for understanding the essence of things.
But the ones everyone loves are the ones full of sharp social commentary, like the hateful things list.
Oh, it's brilliant. And so much of it is still relatable 1,000 years later.
Like what makes the list?
Well, there's the visitor who talks too much and stays too long. We've all been there,
I
right?
confidently a timeless annoyance.
But then she gets really specific to her life, like a man who stayed the night secretly and is trying to leave before dawn.
Oh, I remember this one.
But his loud snoring gives him away, mortifying for everyone involved.
That's so specific and funny.
That's why the lists work so well. They ground the very refined, poetic life of the court in everyday, relatable human moments, even
Like a
annoyances.
fly landing on your face when you're trying to talk.
Exactly. She's saying, look, even in this incredibly elegant world, life is still messy. Things are still irritating.
Okay, so after the list, the second type is anecdotal essays.
Right. These are little stories, vignettes, really, focused on court life, rituals, and especially the value placed on wit and intellect.
Because being quick-witted wasn't just for fun in Heian Japan, was it?
Not at all. It was social currency. Sometimes it was crucial for your position, even your survival at court. Intelligence and poetic sensitivity were highly prized.
Is there a good example of that?
The classic one is the story about the snowy day. Empress Titishi is with her ladies-in-waiting, and she casually asks, "How is the snow on Xianglu Peak?"
Okay. Xiangli Peak, is that nearby?
No, that's the point. It's an allusion to a famous classical Chinese poem. Most of the ladies probably just looked confused.
My Shinigan gets it.
Instantly. She knows the poem describes someone rolling up a blind to reveal a snow-covered mountain peak. So without saying a word, she signals for the bamboo blinds of the room to be rolled up, revealing the snow in the garden outside.
Wow. So she answered the Empress's poetic challenge with an action, not words.
Exactly. It showed her deep knowledge, her quickness, her understanding of the aesthetic language of the court. It wasn't just about knowing the poem, it was about responding elegantly.
That's incredible. It really shows how much nuance matters.
It absolutely does. Performing your knowledge aesthetically was key. That's how she built her reputation.
Okay, so lists, anecdotes, and the third section, diary entries.
Yes. And this is where the tone often shifts, becomes more personal, more poignant. These entries provide the real emotional arc of the book, and they mostly center on her relationship with Empress Teishi.
Her loyalty to the Empress comes through so strongly.
Fiercely loyal, almost defiant at times, Teishi seems to represent, for Shinnagon, the absolute ideal of refined, cultured, aristocratic womanhood.
But things didn't end well for Empress Teishi, did they? There was political turmoil.
That's the tragic element. Takeshi's family, the powerful Fujiwara clan, started losing influence to political rivals. This put the Empress in a very difficult, unstable position.
Which would directly affect Shinnagon as her lady-in-waiting.
Absolutely. Teishi suffered humiliations, loss of status, and ultimately died quite young. This decline in tragedy cast a shadow over the later parts of the book.
So the tone shifts from that bright, witty observation.
Right. It moves from that feeling of okashi, which is all about the charming, the delightful, the witty surface of life, towards something deeper, more melancholic.
Which is.
It's often described by the Japanese aesthetic term mono no aware. It's a kind of gentle sadness or pathos about the transience of things, an awareness that beauty is fleeting.
So the book isn't just celebrating the golden age of the court.
It's also mourning its passing, or at least the passing of her empress's fortunes. She's writing to remember, maybe even to hold on to, a world that's slipping away.
Adds a whole other layer to it. Okay, let's try and weave these threads together. What are the big takeaway themes for the listener?
Well, we just touched on the main aesthetic one, that interplay between okashi and mono no aware.
The delight in the surface and the underlying awareness of impermanence.
Exactly. Okashi is about appreciating the witty remark, the perfect color combination, the charming detail. But Mono no aware is the understanding that these things won't last, which paradoxically makes the appreciation even deeper.
It's not sadness that stops enjoyment, but the knowledge of fleetingness that enhances it.
Precisely. And that leads straight into the next big theme, the sheer power of attention.
Just paying attention.
Yes. Shinogane implicitly argues throughout the book that the act of careful, sustained, honest observation is transformative. It's a form of wisdom, maybe even a spiritual practice in itself.
You don't need a grand philosophical system. You just need to really look at what's in front of you.
Mm-hmm. And the third theme I'd highlight is her exploration of miyabi, or cultural refinement.
Which was obviously central to Heian court life.
Absolutely. But Shinogane isn't just blindly celebrating it. She celebrates genuine refinement, genuine sensitivity. But she uses her wit to critique clumsiness, vulgarity, superficiality.
So miyabi wasn't just about knowing the rules.
It was also a tool for social positioning, even exclusion. She navigates this complex world, appreciating real elegance while mocking those who are just trying too hard or getting it wrong. It becomes a test of character.
That's really interesting. It's refinement, but with judgment.
Definitely. Okay, should we talk about some specific lines? Her phrasing is often so memorable.
Yes, let's do that. She has some truly classic quotes, like the very beginning of the book.
Ah, yes. In spring, it is the dawn that is most beautiful.
It sounds simple, but it's so specific.
That's the key. She's not just saying spring is nice. She demands precision. When in spring, the dawn. And then she goes on to describe why the way the light catches the hills, the purple clouds, it requires focused aesthetic judgment.
Not just generalization. Okay, what about one that captures her whole philosophy?
I think this one sums up the pillow book perfectly. The beauty of life is in small details, not in the whole picture.
That explains everything, doesn't it? Her focus on lists, tiny moments, sensory details.
Exactly. Forget the grand narrative. Look closely at the texture, the nuance. That's where the truth, or at least the interest, lies for her.
Okay, one more. Maybe one that shows her sharp, maybe even slightly cynical side.
How about this observation on lovers? A good lover will behave as elegantly at dawn as at any other time.
Ouch. That's setting a high bar.
Isn't it? It's that mix of romantic realism and aesthetic judgment. The romance of the night fades, the practicalities of morning arrive. Does the elegance remain?
It shows her sharp eye for the gap between ideals and, well, how people actually behave.
Absolutely. She sees through the performance.
Which is probably why so much of this feels relevant today. How can we apply these thousand-year-old ideas?
Well, one direct application, drawing from her lists and constant observation, is to try keeping a kind of modern pillow book.
Like a journal.
Yeah, but specifically focus on noticing the details.
Yeah.
What specific thing today was delightful, charming, Okashi? What specific thing was annoying or hateful?
It forces you to pay attention, to find richness in the ordinary. Could improve life satisfaction, maybe?
I think so. It's a form of secular mindfulness, really. Another tip is using her methods to improve our own social observation skills.
How so?
She was brilliant at seeing inconsistencies, reading social pressures, noticing the gap between words and actions. We can try to apply that same keen eye to our own environments.
Like workplace dynamics
or
family gatherings. See what's really going on beneath the surface.
Exactly. Look for the subtle cues, the unguarded moments, just like she did. And maybe a third application comes from her own life, balancing her role at court.
Balancing authenticity with social demands.
Precisely. She had to meet these incredibly high expectations for refinement and behavior, but she clearly kept her own sharp judgment and integrity intact.
That feels very relevant for navigating, say, corporate culture or academic settings today, where there's often pressure to conform.
Right. Her life offers a model, perhaps, for how to participate authentically while still maintaining your own critical perspective.
So, wrapping things up,
What's
the final takeaway for you from diving back into the pillow book?
For me, it's the powerful idea that profound wisdom can emerge simply from sustained, honest observation, especially when it's combined with that deep aesthetic sensitivity and, importantly, intellectual independence.
Like living attentively is itself an art form.
Yes. That's beautifully put. What surprised you most revisiting it?
You know, it's how utterly universal so many of her observations and critiques feel.
Mm.
Her hateful things could have been written yesterday.
Right.
And it's a reminder that sophisticated conversation, wit, sharp judgment, these are timeless social skills. People haven't fundamentally changed that much in 1,000 years.
The world is rich enough, detailed enough to keep us contemplating for a lifetime if we just pay attention like, say, Shinogane did. That's a powerful lesson.
A really powerful thought to leave everyone with.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.